Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Climbing Majority podcast, where Kyle and I sit down with living legends, professional athletes, certified guides, and recreational climbers alike to discuss the topics, lessons, stories, and experiences found in the life of a climber. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. In today's ever-increasingly polarized world, it can be difficult to have challenging conversations. Kyle and I are both well aware that the issue of representation in sport is one that does not affect us personally. However, we were lucky enough to sit down with all-around rad dude, climber extraordinaire, and recent new father, Eddie Taylor, to learn about his ascents and what his thoughts were on the topic of representation. As a black climber in a predominantly white climbing climate, Eddie gives us his perspective. For those of you who don't know, Eddie is a very accomplished climber. He has summited Denali, he summited Everest as a part of the first all-black Everest expedition under Phil Henderson, he's climbed the nose in a day, and he sent the infamous Moonlight Buttress, to name a few of his accomplishments. Talking with Eddie, it was clear, though, that climbing was only a part of the importance in his life. Eddie is a chemistry teacher and track coach, and he expressed the importance of family and giving back to his community. In this conversation, we discuss some of Eddie's notable ascents, what to look for in climbing partners, representation in the climbing community, and much more.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Climbing Majority podcast. We are sitting down here with Eddie Taylor. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're just going to get going here. Eddie, you are a very accomplished and I would assume a very busy person. A summarization of kind of some of the things you've done in the past. You started in track and field, you were a decathlete, you got into climbing. You have a chemistry degree. You are now a chemistry teacher. You teach track and field. And in your climbing realm, you are also super successful. You have Moonlight Buttress under your belt, nose in a day, Everest. The list goes on. My question here is, how is this possible? How do you get all of this done? Life gets super busy. You technically have two full-time jobs. You're a husband. You're a recent parent. And now, entering the realm of a professional rock climber, I think there's plenty of people in the world that would consider just parenting and a full-time job alone almost too much to handle, and feel like they might not have enough time for their hobbies. So how do you feel like you manage your time, and how do you make this life that you're living possible?
Oh man, that's like a really hard question. Honestly, I don't even know. I just try my best at every time. You know what I mean? Like if I'm at work, I'm focusing on work. If I'm coaching, I'm focusing on coaching. And I just, I really try hard when I'm not doing either of those two things. And I'm not at home hanging out with my wife and kid as we're trying to figure out some time to climb. And it's hard. Like, I can't really say it's an easy thing. I've been trying to get a little bit more disciplined in the time I'm out actually climbing. And like you guys know, you go to the gym and you like talk and you hang out and you do those things, and now I've kind of had to really tighten things up to try to maintain in all those different areas.
And so what's like this kind of lifestyle takes a like you said, you have to trim things up, there's sacrifice, like, and that requires dedication and motivation. So like, what inspires you to try so hard and to try to achieve all of these things that you've done?
I mean, I love climbing. Like, ever since I started rock climbing, I love climbing. I've always tried to make it something that I don't know, something that I get out and do. I've definitely like structured my life around how can I go out and how can I climb more and how can we make this happen? But also without giving up, it's kind of always a climber's dream to like quit your job and go on the road and live in the van and, spend months and months on end at the creek or wherever you're at. But I mean, the way I've grown up, I've always, I've wanted to make sure that I could have a job and, find that stability and also give back to the community. And that's kind of what I do with my teaching career. And so for me, like climbing's awesome. I love it. It's amazing. But at the same time, I don't think it would be as satisfying if I wasn't, if I didn't have that other half where I'm giving back to the community and I'm, you know, working with kids and helping try to shape their futures. So it's a hard balance, but things really fit together if you kind of like really think about it. Like with the teaching, right? You have summers off, and those are not the best time to climb in the US, but you can still go to some really cool areas. And then with the teaching, like throughout the year, it makes you have to be disciplined in training and have to be like disciplined in your time. And so I kind of feel like it's almost like I have like a climbing season and almost like a training off season, which works really well.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. I think that's something we advocate here on the podcast a lot is finding balance in our lives. I think that's one thing that I learned personally after my injury, is that, you know, there was more in my life that I needed to find out, and there was more meaning to be had outside of climbing. And so it's interesting that, you know, you found that early on, and there's this calling that you have outside of climbing. But I think the interesting thing here is that, you know, you're achieving these amazing things in climbing while still having that mentality. And I think a lot of people think that in order to achieve some of the things that you've done, whether that be Nose in a Day or Moonlight Buttress, where you need to dedicate a large portion of your time towards climbing, and they might not be achievable without it. And I definitely, you know, feel like that a little bit. Like if I wanted to do some of the things you've done, I'd have to change my life tremendously and dedicate more time to climbing. So what do you attribute your success in that realm with having, you know, dual focuses in your life?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I always feel like I need to do more to become a better climber and to do the next best thing. Like I think that's kind of just a natural feeling that everybody has. And I think for me, it's just, like in whatever form, I love getting out climbing, right? Like if I'm going to put a, you know, most of these trips, like even Moonlight Buttress, it started as, all right, I want to go on a big climbing trip. Boom. Okay. I got to take these days off. I got to plan it. I start putting all the planning into it. And then, I'm going to show up and I'm going to do the best I can. And so I can't really say that it's necessarily like I am really focused on training to that level or to some level. It's just, I'm, you know, that's my break. That's the time I have, but I'm going to go out and like I said, do the best I can.
Would you consider yourself a naturally gifted climber?
I don't think so.
you have a very laissez-faire attitude towards the, I think, or a laissez-faire or humble attitude towards these achievements and kind of your performance in climbing. I find that interesting. You know, because I look at you and I'm, you know, inspired and like, wow, like how do you, you know, you get all this done, and, you know, to hear just like, oh yeah, you know, I make the plan and I go, you know, it makes me wonder if like there's something else there. Max, like, do you, you know, have anything to add there in terms of just like that attitude and all that?
I think something that I'd like to just tease out a little bit more, and this is like just totally self-interested from my own perspective, is I think it's easy to see individuals such as yourself, Eddie, who do seem to, you know, maybe, I don't know, you might have a different opinion, but like, I would say like you have it all, you're doing so many things, and there's kind of maybe a casual, like, I don't know, like I've kind of just put this together. And sometimes for me, that doesn't fully tease out like actually the process that you went through to get to where you are and how you're feeling and how you've managed to do that. Does that make sense? Like to slowly, progressively take on more and more, at least that's the assumption I'm making. And like, so an example I could give is right now I'm a full-time student. I'm, you know, with my girlfriend, she works full-time, you know, and she supports me. It's this really interesting kind of relationship, and I'm, you know, stressed to the max. Like my life is I'm struggling right now, like in, you know, stressed to the max, funny Max, but, you know, I am struggling a lot right now, and I want to take on more. And like, I know with like my partner, Ray, like we want to have a kid, you know, like we really do, but like, we can't see how that would be feasible at all to take on more responsibility right now and stuff. And so like, I look at someone like you where it's like, I could dedicate 10 lifetimes and I don't think I'd ever be destined to like climb Moonlight Buttress or anything, even if I just lived in a van and did that. And so I'm wondering, like, was this process something that you kind of just like slowly developed, or was this really like this like arduous, hard process? And maybe you're underselling that a little bit. Like, what was that like for you? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, again, I mean, I guess it's everyone's experience, right? Like you're saying you can never climb Moonlight Buttress. There's plenty of climbs where I'm like, man, I'm never going to climb 514. I'm never going to climb 515. I know I'm never going to climb 515, but, but like, you know, I'm looking at those like things and I'm like, there's things I can, I'm never going to do, but I think that's changed a lot of times in my life. And I would say it's really hard to answer this question. I would say when I was in college, I ran track, and in track, I, you know, dedicated 35 to 40 hours a week training. Plus I had a double major. Plus, you know, I tried to maintain some sort of social life. And so like I was doing a lot then, and you know, it was just expected of you, and that's what you wanted to do. You know, I wanted to make sure that I was, you know, doing the best I could in school. I felt like I had a lot of pressure in those regards, as well as, you know, track was a very important thing to my life. And so I was trying to balance all of those then. And I feel like by doing that for 4 years, plus, you know, growing up, I did sports and all of the things. I think a lot of people have, but I feel like I kind of got practice at having to balance those things and just having to take a lot on and, you know, having to just accept it. Like it's good, it's bad. It's just the way life is. And so I think, you know, moving past there, when I think I had a little bit more flexibility in my life, I was more, I guess my capacity to take on more was there. And I think that's kind of what's helped me progress in climbing and to be able to balance these type, like this many things. But with that said, I know you asked, like, do you feel like you're a naturally gifted climber? Honestly, I don't. I just started a training program recently and I did the assessment and I'm like below one sigma in almost every category. Meaning like I'm like far outside of the range of average for like how much I can hang on a hangboard, how long I can hang on the hangboard, how flexible I am. So it's like I can't say I'm the most gifted, especially when you start looking at those hardcore numbers, but I think I do have a knack for learning technique and learning how to climb, like use my, what I have to the best of my ability.
I think the ability to take on more, the ability to be busy all the time. I think that a lot of people who find themselves in that space experience, you know, what's called burnout. I ran cross country and track throughout high school. And I burned out. It was too much. I took on too much. And for me, I think it was because I lost a passion in what I was doing. How have you managed to avoid burnout and continue to have a passion for everything that you're doing? Because it's so required in order to stay as busy as you are.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that after college track, I competed a little bit afterwards, and I got, for lack of a better word, burned out from track as well. Yeah. But with that said, I was still like interested in how far I could push myself. And I loved the community that I had when I was running track. And I didn't really have that after college. And kind of when I got into climbing was like, oh man, you have success all the, like, you know, when you race, when you're doing track or jumping or any of those, like you fail all the time. Like you're never doing better than you can. But climbing, every time you hop on a new route, you're like, oh man, that's a success. I hop on to try this other route. That's a success. You try a new style of climbing. That's a success. And so I feel like I really enjoyed that. And that's part of climbing that I think has really kept me inspired and invigorated. Plus like the climbing community is huge. You know, everywhere you go, you meet a climber, you know, you see like they have like a carabiner in their keys and you're like, oh man, you're a climber. I'm a climber. Cool. you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, you know, you have that community, you have like all those markers and milestones for success. And then you get to travel and see cool places. Like those three things, I think for me, it helps me not get burnt out of climbing. And again, like I know I have friends who, you know, they enter the sport, they leave the sport. A lot of times they're very focused on grades or what they can achieve there. And I guess honestly, I haven't at this point. So
that's really interesting. Like what you're saying about maybe not necessarily being like super focused on grades and stuff. You know, I'm wondering if we can maybe dive into these two ascents we've kind of, you know, talked about here, which is the nose and moonlight. You know, like what was this big like catalyst for you to want to take on these kind of projects? And maybe if we can like dive into that, that'd be really great.
Yeah. Well, the nose, that I guess I think I did that before moonlight. The nose is interesting. So probably me wanting to climb the nose started back in, say, 2018, I think. Anyways, I went, I guess in 2018, I climbed Mount Watkins with a coworker, and it's a big climb in the valley. It's like one of the three biggest walls in Yosemite. You have Half Dome, Mount Watkins, and you have El Cap. And so I was like, I was talking to my coworker, and he's like, oh, well, you've climbed Denali. You're like a pretty decent trad climber. We should go climb a wall together. And I was like, sure. I didn't know anything back then in terms of what big wall climbing was and whatnot. And so we put this trip together. We planned. We didn't train at all, to be honest. He was like, oh, yeah, I climbed El Cap like four or five times back in the day. And he was a bit older than me. But we didn't really train. And as we were getting closer, I was getting nervous. And I asked a couple of my friends, hey, okay, I know you've climbed the nose. I know you've big walled, like, show me how to aid climb. I need to know how to aid climb, or else this is not going to be a fun time. And so I went to this local crack where, like, I tell everyone, like, this is how you learn to climb the nose. You go climb this crack. But I went to Country Club Crack, and I spent probably 2 weeks there, coming almost every day after work. And first, I belayed my friend, and he kind of showed me how to aid up this crack. And then, you know, I got my turn on lead, and then I learned how to, like, top rope solo, and I started, like, learning how to aid climb on top rope solo. And then kind of by the end of those 2 weeks, I was like, all right, well, I know this is how you lead rope solo, which he showed me as well. And so I could just, like, figure out all of the aiding there very slowly on my own. And this was probably like 7 or 8 sessions at that point. And it was time to go to Yosemite. And that was an adventure, to say the least. First of all, we drove into the valley, and, you know, you pass El Cap, and then you keep driving all the way to the back of the valley before we had to start this. I think it's like 6 miles to Watkins or something like that. I don't really remember. But we brought the biggest rack possible. I think it said you need a triple rack. My coworker was like, we should bring a quad rack.
Sounds like me on a free climb.
Sounds like standard 5'8 climbing to me.
And we were like, oh, we want to go light. So only one haul bag. So we brought a backpack and one haul bag. I ended up having to carry the haul bag. And then it's supposed to be a clean aid route, but it said, oh, it could be missing pin, like fixed pins or things. So we brought a hammer. We brought all this metal that never left the bag the entire trip. Yeah. And
good training.
I had about I would imagine 100-pound pack hiking out to the base of Mount Watkins. So it was pretty rough. And when we got there, I didn't know how to aid climb. So, well, I learned a little bit, but like I still had never done it on a big wall. And so like the first day, typically you climb the route, and then, I mean, people do it in a few hours, but typically it's 3 to 4 days. And the first day we got 2 pitches up. And at that point, my coworker was like, you know, that wall is just so big. I don't know if I can lead anything. So if we're going to the top, you're going to have to lead everything.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
And, needless to say, we did get to the top.
Yeah.
Wow.
But that was on the sixth day. We were out of water. We topped out. We weren't going to climb at night at all, because I guess modern climbers climb at night. And back in the day, they never climbed at night. So we only climbed at night when we ran out of water and we had to get to the top. It was just, it was slow and go. A couple pitches a day until the last day when we did the second half of the route, because we kind of had to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at that point, I was like, I'm done. I'm going to quit climbing. This is too much. And we hiked all the way back down to the car. We went and, like, I don't even remember where we slept, but I think we drove out of the park and we, like, stayed at a hotel for that night, like, ate some food. And I was still like, man, I'm done. But there was 3 more days to my flight back home. And we went back and we, like, hiked up to El Cap. And I was like, man, because this is like a 20-minute hike versus this, like, 4-hour hike with a 100-pound haul bag. And we were just like kind of exploring the base, and I was pretty worked at the same time. But when I got home, I was like, okay, wait a second. So you can climb a longer route, a cooler route. I can't say the nose is much more cooler than Watkins, but longer route, cooler route, way shorter approach. And you don't have to have a 100-pound haul bag. And that's kind of what really got me stoked on wanting to do the nose.
Just good selling point there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. In general, do you just find that, okay, at least the sense that I get from you is like kind of a little laissez-faire, but also like really like go-getter attitude. Do you find that you stay just positive in bad situations pretty well?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I do pretty well, is kind of like I can kind of keep focused on the goal and stay positive. And for me, I think that's something that, like, I think that's why a lot of people want to climb with me, or at least a lot of my climbing partners say they want to climb with me.
It goes a long way.
I bet. I was going to say, Kyle, I think that's in itself is kind of like a superpower. Like, there's so many times in life, I think, that people are actually capable of doing things. But if you can't like keep your calm, keep a positive attitude and be willing to try, then you just like won't be able to do it. So like having that ability to kind of like do what, you know, you alluded to there essentially is like, I think that can just get you so far in life and do so many things, you know. Like, I think there's tons of things I could climb that I'm just not willing to try, or that I haven't been, or that I've been hamstringing myself with these kind of arbitrary, you know, non-existent mental barriers of saying, like, you know, even at the beginning of this conversation, we started off by saying like, oh, I'll never climb, you know, 512. And you're like, well, I thought the same thing about myself. Right. And like, you know, here you are now X amount of time later where you have like accomplished these things. So that's an interesting thing. I think that just, you know, the arbitrary slash false limitations we put on ourselves as individuals that are hamstringing us, that, you know, really just aren't true. Right. Like, I don't know.
That's
something interesting.
Yeah. And I think part of it's kind of like, you know, there's things like I said at the end of that story, like, yeah, I really wanted to climb the nose because of all of X, Y, and Z. But honestly, if I didn't have that opportunity, someone didn't drag me to try Mount Watkins, maybe I would have never gotten that psyched on the nose or felt like I was prepared to do it. So I kind of feel like there's a balance between like goals that you set for yourself and you want to pick, and then those just random opportunities. A friend's like, hey, do you want to go try this route, or do you want to go blame me on this route? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you try it and you're like, oh, okay, maybe I can climb this grade, or maybe I can do this super sandbagged route. So I kind of feel like it's kind of that balance, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, if I think of for myself, like what got me into climbing, like I was at this particular period of my life where I needed a lot of change. My mother was like terminally ill with cancer at the time. And this gentleman, Terry Louie, at the store I was working with, you know, he just like one day we were talking, having a good laugh, and he was like, hey, do you want to go like ice climbing with me? And it was like, yeah, like, fuck yeah, I want to go do that. That seems awesome. And like went and did that. And that was my first time climbing outside ever. And it was like, you know, that day, just, this was the raddest thing I had ever done. It wasn't really on my radar. I wasn't really thinking about it too much. I was getting into endurance sports at the time, but like having that person, you know, be there to like mentor slash offer the opportunity to me, like, completely transformed my life. Like, I just dove, like, I'm not exactly the most talented climber ever, but like I dove head first. It's like climbing was just like, it was like, whatever this is, it's so rad. I like, my life just needs this in it all the time. Like, I'm like full spiritually as a human being when I'm doing these kind of things, if that makes sense. Right. And yeah, it was life transformative. So I think that is like a crazy thing to think about for sure. What was like what was like the impetus or like the catalyst for you, like getting involved in climbing? Like, how did that happen? Who helped you with that? Usually there's someone I find helped you into that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of alluded to this a bit earlier, but like when I got into climbing, I was getting burnt out of track and field. I was training by myself. I was still trying to pole vault a little bit higher than I had in college, and I was getting better, but it's just hard to train by yourself. And I had lived in Boulder for 5 years at that point, and I didn't know what climbing was other than, like, you know, people going and climbing Mount Everest. It's kind of like my joke I always say. I'm like, that's literally all I knew about climbing before 2013. And a friend invited me to go climbing, and I went out. She gave me a Grigory. She gave me a harness, and I tried it for the first time. I belayed her on her 5.8 project, and she sent it, and I went up after, and that was like my first day out climbing.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm not sure everybody gets that opportunity, right? Like, you know, people, like, you know, for myself too, like Bryce, my buddy Bryce, just invited me to climb the nose, and it's like, you know, why did he choose me? Like, you know, and why did someone invite the invitation to you, Eddie, and Max, the same thing? Like, why is someone inviting this to you? Like, in a way, you know, there is a level of sacrifice, I guess. It depends on the circumstances. But at the same time, too, it's like that person's choosing you for a reason. So like, what kind of person do you want to be? And what kind of person are you to kind of attract that in your life? And I think that that boils back down to like just a general stoke for life, for people, putting yourself out in the community and being connected with other people, having a good, you know, good connection with people, having a good attitude. Like, you know, what other characteristics do you feel, you know, would kind of attract more of those opportunities for people?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess like everyone picks partners for different reasons, I think. Like me and a couple of our other friends, we always talk about like our list of partners, right? And our list of partners is curated in certain ways, right? Like mine, which I got from a climbing partner, is like ability, compatibility, and availability, right? Like if you have 2 hours to climb a week, you got to find someone who has time to go climbing.
100%.
But at the same time, right? Like, okay, the times work out, but okay, do they have the ability? Can they do that route that you want to do? Are they compatible? Will it be fun to do that route that you want to do? And so I kind of feel like, at least for me, those are like the three things that I look at. And I think that it, you know, it kind of balances out a little bit, you know, like if the ability is not there, well, maybe you have to change the objective. If the availability is not there, well, at this point in my life, well, it's just like too bad.
That's actually cool. I've never heard those, like the three pillars of choosing a partner. I like that a lot. I think the one thing that's funny that I've run into is like, you know, I've been blessed and where I haven't had a lot of issues trying to find a partner. And I kind of wondered for a while, I was like, oh, like that sucks. Like, why are people struggling to find partners? Like, and then I realized it's like, because I'm not climbing that hard. You know, it's like when you get to a certain level and you're starting to choose these harder climbs, the pool of people that you can climb with starts to shrink rapidly. And so it just becomes really hard to find someone, the ability pillar, like you were saying.
And you always like, you kind of get locked into like the same group of people. And I think that's, I mean, it's nice and it's also, it's hard a lot of times in general, right? Like I get locked into climbing with my same couple partners. And I've definitely made an effort in the last couple of years to kind of expand that. Cause one, you just learn from more, the more people you climb with, the more you learn from. And then also I think that like, I mean, it's just the reality of it. Like climbing is a sport that is in, you know, only small certain groups of people climb, right? Like in general, like things have changed for the past years, but you know, we even talk about like race, right? Like I, until 2 or 3 years ago, had climbed with my sister and pretty much no other Black person. And that's because, you know, that's, you know, I live in Boulder, Colorado. That's what the folks I'm locked into climbing with all the time. And I know that they're available. I know that we're compatible. I know they have those abilities. And so I think like there's pros and cons to having those same partners, but also it's definitely keeps the sport the way it is.
So I think that's an interesting thing to tease out there. And like, you know, there's like the obvious like elephant in the room here for everybody watching the video. Like, you know, Kyle and I are two white dudes, like you're a Black dude and climbing is this, you know, it is this like European, you know, Caucasian centric kind of dominated sport. And so I guess like, how do you view representation in the climbing community? And like, what are the implications of that? If that makes sense, like what is the importance of this representation?
I mean, I think it's just important in anything you do, right? Like if you can't see yourself doing it, then why are you going to want to do it? Right. Like, obviously that's changing, but most of us climbers didn't grow up with our parents climbing, right? If you're Black, you're white, you're Mexican, whatever, like your parents didn't grow up climbing. But if you are interested in climbing, you look, you're like, okay, well, maybe I want to try this thing called climbing, or I want to go climb El Cap, or I want to go do these things. If you don't see anyone that looks like you, like when you pop into a Google search or something, like it's not going to be something that you're going to have this strong desire to do, even if it's just subconscious, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I would just say most people aren't outdoors people. So I'm not trying to say like, you know, one person's more suited to that than the other. It's just when you start looking at it, that's where I think representation is really important.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you had said that in the climbing community, there is approximately 1% of representation of Black athletes in the climbing community. Is that correct?
That's from like a American Alpine Club study where they like interviewed climbers. I actually don't know how scientifically accurate that is or isn't.
I mean, but, nonetheless, it paints the picture of a small minority of representation. And you kind of had teased out a little bit of saying, you know, if I don't see someone that looks like me doing something, I'm not going to be inspired to do it, whether that's subconscious or not. Do you feel like that's the only reason why the representation is so low? Or do you feel like there might, you know, there are other things that are in, you know, in the playing field for that?
I mean, yeah, at the most basic level, I mean, I think that's what's at play, but I mean, there's plenty of other reasons, right? Like, I think it's really hard to, I joked about earlier, like I would never want to, in my, like from my lived experience, like I would never want to like risk the safety of a nice, you know, having my nice job and things like, well, teaching's and I can't say it's a nice job, but a job that I enjoy to, to go live on the road and live in my van and whatnot. And I think that just like as a community, I think I can only really speak to the Black community, but like, I think a lot of people haven't grown up with that. Like a lot of people, you know, they're one generation out from their families owning a home or one generation out from maybe at least me, like my parents getting a degree in college, you know? So I think societally wise, I'm not saying every individual, but I think that becomes a lot more difficult to really take it and get into climbing, if that makes sense. And then, you know, there also is a lot of like history of like climbing in small towns and the, you know, all the racism and things that we have in our history that does make climbing a little bit more difficult and feel inaccessible. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think that representation piece is like the thing that we can like concrete fix right now, as well as, you know, I mean, I bring this back to teaching. There's some statistics out there where like 2% of the teachers are Black male teachers. And there's also statistics that you are significantly more successful if you have a teacher that comes from your demographic, if you have one teacher that comes from your demographic. So, you know, think about like, I talk, you know, it's funny because I've used this example at school, right? If you're a white student in my school is like 30% Latino, 70% white. There's maybe one Latino teacher. If you're a white kid at my school, or we can be more specific, a white girl at our school, you're going to have 75, 80% of the teachers are going to be like you, right? A white lady. But if you are a Black kid or you're a Latino kid at that school, there's a very small, very, very small percentage that in your entire high school career, you're not going to see a single person that looks like you. And so it just, again, I don't know the mechanism behind it, but it does make things harder to learn. And so you think about that community-wise, right? Like there's not a lot of Black people climbing, but then someone tries to get into climbing and they don't see anyone that's like you. And maybe you've come from a community where you've learned from people that have been more like you. So it's a little bit harder to learn, if that makes sense.
No, I think it's an interesting point. And like, obviously, like, you know, you kind of use the phrase like lived experience. Like, I don't have this lived experience at all. You know, like this is not something that I can like put myself in the shoes of and like credit to that. Like, but something I am wondering is, so for example, you are this anomaly, you could say, right? And so what do you accredit, or maybe just like elaborate a little bit, what do you feel kind of got you in the door into this community despite that lack of representation and stuff? Is there something that you can think about with that? Like,
yeah. I mean, my mom's first job, she worked with the Indian Health Service. And so we moved around all around the country and we lived in, you know, like when I was really young, I lived in primarily Black neighborhoods, but from 7, 8 on, I was living in a lot of different communities. I lived in Michigan where we were one of the few Black families. I moved to Gallup, New Mexico and Kayenta, Arizona. In Kayenta, Arizona, there were like 5 families that were non-Navajo in the entire town. So,
yeah.
I mean, that, I think that that's a very interesting place to live. And then I moved up to Minnesota where, again, I was one of the maybe 2 Black families in the small town we lived in. So like, I've been conditioned to, I don't know if conditioned is the right word, but I've spent a lot of time in my life learning and, you know, getting to know people that are outside of, you know, the way I was brought up. And so I spent so much time doing that, that I think like it was kind of more natural for me after, you know, graduating college to be like, oh yeah, I can, you know, I can climb, I can learn these things, I can be good at these type of things. I don't know.
No, I think that's interesting. And like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but at least to me, like maybe what I tease out of that is like, from your own experience moving around and having these different like cultural experiences and being exposed to these different groups, there's almost kind of this like mutual like symbiosis, right? It's like I benefit from that and you benefit from that, from us being exposed like to these different kind of like, you could call it societal norms or cultures or differences, right? Where it's like there's like this growth that both people can experience. So it's like this mutual relationship where we can both just benefit from that, if that makes sense, right? Like, does that make sense?
100% agree. 100% agree. I mean, yeah. I always talk about these things in terms of like, I mean, the representation's a hard topic, right? Like you don't want to alienate people. You don't want to like I'm never like calling someone out or saying anything like that. But I mean, I think it's a hard topic, but I mean, I just think as things get more normal, like, it helps everybody, right? Like it's not weird all of a sudden to see a black person at the crag. Like that's just normal. Like it doesn't have to be for some type of special diversity event or something. Like it's like, no, I live 15 minutes from Eldo. I climb there 2-3 days a week because I live close to there and that's just normal. And I think the more people are out, the more normalized that is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, obviously I don't know from personal experience, but you know, like I have,
yeah,
at least in some ways, like a darker sense of humor. And I hope this doesn't come across wrong. But like, for example, there's a quote from one of the articles here where like you were on a ski lift and, you know, the person wanted to congratulate you for being the first black person on a ski lift. And like, to me, like I just like process that as humor because it's like unfucking believable that like in 2024, there's like, you know, somebody who's going to like congratulate a black person for like being on a ski lift. So I don't mean it's like comical in the aspect of like, that's funny. Like, it's funny how ignorant and ridiculous that like just premises in itself, if that makes sense. Right. And so sometimes we can be in our own local areas and assume like, oh, like, you know, maybe that's happening everywhere. You know what I mean? When in reality, like, for example, like I live in BC, it's a pretty progressive area. We talk a lot about like just race relations, and particularly here, there isn't like a large black culture, obviously, if anybody's been to BC understands, but like there's a lot of these issues are kind of analogous to the Aboriginal issues, right? And so, yeah, like, you know, it's easy to like project like, oh, everybody's having these discussions or everybody's aware of this. And then you hear of examples like this and it's like, I don't really know how that would affect me as an individual. And maybe it's easy to brush that off. And so I'm wondering, like, how much do you attribute that to really like having effect like on individuals getting into these sports? Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. And I mean, honestly, for me, like, it's just like a funny story. Like, I don't really feel like I'm like, oh man, that guy like pointed me out. But like, I've just been so used to that. But I think for someone else, like someone else who hasn't had a lot of those experiences, they, you know, that might feel like, oh man, am I supposed to be here? This seems weird, you know? But yeah, I mean, you're right. People are just in general are so much like so in their bubbles. And it's the way it is. I mean, I don't know how, I always think about this example. Okay. So like my wife is always like, there's no way, like how would Trump win? And then I'm like, well, you look at the Facebook and like the town I grew up on, like every single person's voting for Trump. And then we live in Boulder and every single person's like, you know, anti-Trump. And so it's just like, everyone lives in this bubble where they're like, they feel like every single other person in the world thinks exactly the same way they do, which is obviously just not the case.
Yeah, I think to also like tease something out there, which I at least my estimation on these incredibly inflammatory, you know, like politics, race, a lot of these things have almost become like sports teams, you know, like two sides yelling at each other. And the reality is like, we actually want either side to get together and like have a conversation. Like it's in everybody's best interest, back to like what you alluded to, where it's like having these different cultural experiences, it's like symbiosis to like get people to like get together. But sometimes it's really easy to kind of just do like finger pointing at other groups, if that makes sense. And that like is divisive in itself, just like makes you makes the person not receptive to the conversation or the argument you're going to have. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it could be really easy. And like, I feel like going out on a limb here, but it'd be really easy for me to just blow off like, so what? There's not that many like Black people in your area. Like, how could that really affect you, you know, getting into climbing? But like, in reality, that actually really could have like a drastic effect. And like, just dismissing that argument is like a really bad idea, because like, I don't actually understand that from my position, because I've been fortunate enough, and you know, people would use the terminology like privilege to not have to experience that or deal with that. And so I just think like there's like a middle ground here. I don't know, like to just trying to create a path where yeah, like you can just get somebody who's maybe not as receptive to your idea to be receptive to that idea. You know what I mean? Like I've seen online where like people have been in comment sections of Instagram or something. Like Kai Leitner would be a good example of this, where like I've seen him post like things in the comment section of like people just kind of really missing the point of like certain things he's trying to make about like representation or his like recent ascent. I forget the name of the climb. It's like a 515A climb. But like, it's just easy to like to miss the point and be inflammatory in today's age, if that makes sense. I feel like I just went way too tangentially and didn't make a good enough point. But no. Like, does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. It makes sense. And honestly, I think, you know, most climbers, regardless of background, I think want to just talk about climbing and not have to feel like they have to talk about representation and those type of things. But I think, I mean, you want to make room for the people coming after you, I think. And so that's kind of why I think a lot of people from different backgrounds feel like they have to talk about those type of things, and they have to talk about representation. They have to, I mean, I talk about representation a lot. And sometimes I don't actually, sometimes I just talk about pure sport, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I call it. But
so I've got two questions here. So one, I think when we were talking about bubbles, I too am in a very, I would consider a pretty small bubble. And mixing this with the comment that the guy made on the ski lift, you know, if I were at a crag and I saw a Black climber, I wouldn't even really see that person as like a Black person. I'm like very colorblind in that way. I'm not going to like make a comment, be like, oh, there's a Black person here, you know? And so like, to me, like those kind of comments like the guy made on the chairlift are mind blowing to me, that people are even saying these things. And if someone were to ask me, like, you know, if I would be surprised, I basically what I'm saying is I'm surprised that someone would say that. So I'm curious if you can try to help me understand a little bit in terms of maybe some more experiences that you've had at the crag that were maybe like that someone, you know, is kind of recognizing race in a way that might be perceived in a weird way from you, and whether that's, you know, meant as a, you know, a positive or as a negative from that person. I'm just curious as to kind of some, you know, ideas or some experiences you've had in that realm.
Honestly, like, I can't say I've had a lot of those experiences recently. I mean, I have here and there, definitely more when I definitely more in the past than I've had now. But I think a lot of times, I mean, you hear this happen all the time. I have a lot of female climbing partners, and like, you know, they'll show up to a crag, right? And it's always like, okay, people just assume that, like, they'll, like, for instance, I climbed with Nina Williams a bit, and like, literally, we were climbing the Diamond. This was like 2 or 3 years ago, maybe 2 years ago now. We're climbing the Diamond, right? And like, I show up to the top of the first pitch, and we're simul climbing up on the Diamond, and people are like, oh, I'm not sure if they should pass. Maybe you can pass. Oh, no, you can pass. And then like, as I was going by, they looked down, they're like, oh wait, his partner's a girl. Like, I hear them talking to each other. I'm like, you guys know that like my partner climbs like crazy harder than you guys ever will, and you guys are being guided up this right now. Yeah. I think women face a lot of that at the crag, even if they're never, people aren't like, oh man, she's a woman here or there. But a lot of times people get, you know, the questions will be directed to the man, the questions will be directed, like, you know, assuming that like the guy can lead this route here or there. And I think that that's like a really interesting thing. And that happens to me a lot, you know. And then, I mean, it'll even happen, like, people, you know, you can kind of almost see it in their faces, like, you know, me and like one of my, like my wife or one of my female partners, and they're like, okay, so is this black guy leading it or is this woman leading it? Like, it's kind of a,
they're like confused to like, I don't know.
Yeah. And wow. Like, and a lot of times, like, you know, it's definitely, I think it's sometimes a generational thing, sometimes not. Cause I mean, there's plenty of, you know, longtime climbers that are great. And I know them, we have great rapports. And then there are people who are like, I've been climbing here for a long time. And like, you shouldn't be climbing this route this way or doing this thing. Like that's, I've had those exact, like showed up to an ice crag and someone's been like, oh, that route's not leadable. And I'm like, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Let me show you.
Yeah. So that happens. And I think it's just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And I mean, that just makes me like, sorry to beat a dead horse here, but like go back to this like bubble. Like for me in my own bubble, it's like, okay, I show up to like Climbbase 5 is this like local gym for me. It used to be the Edge. Like I show up there. I'm an incredibly self-deprecating person. I have the build of like a rugby player, like, you know, like a large 198 pound man. And then like I go there and there's like 8-year-old like girls like, you know, climbing my like 30-year dream project from now. You know what I mean? It's like, or yeah. like people of color on the team or anything. It just doesn't matter. So like to me, climbing is just this like great equalizer where I would never assume to like be like, oh, I'm better than you. Like, you know, the vast majority of females I've ever climbed with are like way better than me or everybody I've ever climbed with. So like I would never assume to look at another person and be like, your sex or the color, like the pigment of your skin is going to dictate if you can climb, you know, hard. Like most people just climb harder than me. So it just like doesn't even matter to me if that makes sense. And yeah. I think obviously there is like a little bit of maybe ignorance like in that statement for me, but like Kyle kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier. And I'm wondering like what your thought process on like, what do you think of the model of like moving towards like colorblindness, like, you know, like of just like not viewing race or not viewing sex at all? Like, is that something you adhere to, or is there like different models of like thinking about like this long term that you can think about?
It's really hard. And I kind of go back to some of my teaching training when I think about this, right? Because everybody does come in with unique challenges and unique things that have faced them societally wide, right? We talked a little bit about that earlier. In terms of like, if you're, okay, you know, you think about, okay, why aren't there more this person or this person out climbing? Well, you kind of think about where they come from. And so I don't necessarily think that like the color blindness in all aspects is, sorry, I haven't really thought about this fully, but in all aspects is like, is the best way to handle it. But also like, I mean, I think it's just like humans forming biases is like a natural process, right? Like climbing's dangerous. Like climbing is really, really dangerous. Like you can die by one mistake. And so, you know, I think a lot of people in general, right, you make these assumptions, you make these stereotypes just based off of lived experiences, right? And so if you're at the crag and you see someone getting ready to like, I mean, here's an example. I was like 3 years ago, we were at this crag. We were at Eldo, and I saw this group of two guys with bright, shiny new cams, like shoes that you'd climb in the gym with, ready to getting ready to simul-climb this, like, it was a 5.8 route that had some consequence on it. And I didn't say anything. And I kind of felt bad because they epic'd pretty bad on that thing, like right after the second pitch. And it's like, okay, well, I did make an assumption that they probably were going to struggle. They were new, like from the things I noticed, right, was brand new shiny cam. So either they're like, you know, they just got them for some reason, or they always use new cams, or they're brand new climbers. But I, you know, you could have made those assumptions, and I did, but I didn't act on them. And so like, was it right? Was it wrong? I don't really know. And so I think like, if you're someone who's not used to seeing competent people of color out climbing, you're not used to seeing competent women out climbing, those are wrapped into those same assumptions that I made about those folks with the brand new shiny cams and like tarantula laces.
Yeah.
I don't know. So it's really hard to like, sorry. No diss on the tarantula aces.
No, that's totally fine. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think you bring up an interesting point. I think that, yeah, I mean, you in that situation, you could have prevented something bad from happening, but you are also projecting your own observations on those people. And it's like, in the end, it's a hard line to dance. Like, you know, ultimately, obviously, the main rule here is like, be positive. Like, don't use your biases to, you know, present any sort of negative emotions or negative feelings or put people down or to just be negative or hateful in any way. Like, obviously, that's not acceptable and no way anybody should be living. But even if someone's trying to be positive and trying to help somebody else, if it's based around this bias of race or their understanding of the person's appearance, I could see how that could be taken kind of a little bit. You're like, ah, like, come on, dude, you know, like, why are you making that assumption of me or something like that? So in your shoes of somebody who might be making those assumptions, like, what do you feel like the best route for people are? Is it just like to kind of just keep those comments to themselves, or, you know, should we be saying, you know, what we're thinking? Like, it's what do you feel like the dance there is?
Yeah. I mean, I guess like when I reflect on that situation I just brought up, I think, like, I guess as long as your assumption's not necessarily based off of like their appearance or their gender or any one of those type of more like class type things. Mm-hmm. And it's just based off of like pure observation of
like climber to climber. It's like you, yeah, as a climber, you look like you might be underprepared for what you're about to do.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you're a female, I think you might not be prepared for this.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, it's hard to like, what are those exact, like, is there a checklist? All right. Like, are you going to go and like analyze and check off the people at the crag? You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's yeah, such a weird thing. And like, you know, and I don't think it's as bad in sport climbing or in bouldering where that's, it's less consequence. But as you start to get to things that are just significantly more consequence, like, I mean, ice climbing, like, you don't want to fall at all. Right. And if someone takes a big fall on a route, that's like, everyone's having a bad day. So I can, yeah, I see kind of both sides of it, but at the same time, like, I definitely know how it feels to be one of those people that happens to. And like I said, I climb with lots of female climbers who that happens to regularly as well. So it doesn't feel good. And I just don't really have the answer. It's hard.
Yeah. That's definitely a complex situation to navigate. And there's kind of like assessing somebody on competence and then from an underlying position of safety. But then like, is your assessment of competence really like objective, which is of course like there's always bias in every situation, or like have you, you know, created this so-called air quotes, mm-hmm, objective assessment of competence, but in reality race and sex or gender have played a role into your assessment of that, right? And so that's difficult to navigate. I think tangentially this makes me think, I don't know if you maybe like, I'm sure you follow Will Gadd on Instagram or something, maybe not.
Do you? I know of him. Yeah.
Okay. Well, like he was, I think like people had posted, like there was like, it was a couple years ago. There was like this group of climbers who like climbed Yamanuska and they were like in bike helmets and like just like drilling random bolt lines and not hitting in like the expansion bolts deep enough where they're like sticking out, like protruding like crazy. And it was just like the most like unsafe, crazy thing you could ever imagine of people who seem like they had just watched like some climbing video, you know, and then like gone and done this. And then I think afterwards, like Will Gadd actually like reached out to them and like offered to like give them like a free day of like safety training rather than chastising them. But I recommend anybody listening, go like look it up. It's actually quite like it's kind of like endearing at the end of it that it had like this good thing, but it was like just these two dudes just like just totally out to lunch going and doing something unbelievably dangerous. And so I think that's like clearly like an obvious like black and white, you know, like situation where it's just like, yeah, like that was not that for sure.
Yeah.
I'd like to steer the conversation a little bit. So back to when we were talking about representation, you had said that, you know, sometimes you don't feel like talking about representation or, you know, you just want to talk about climbing. There's a specific article that was written by Climbing Magazine or climbing.com. And it mentioned just the topic of first black ascent. Like, what does that phrase mean to you, and what are your thoughts behind it?
I mean, I guess it means whatever you want it to mean. I know, I think when my friend quit, I'm more friends with the writer now than I was before she wrote it. But I don't think that wasn't her intent on writing the article. I think she was really stoked and inspired by it. And I think that's kind of where climbing took it and ran with it. And it was, I mean, I remember the Instagram comments for that thing. Like, people were like, see, look, he says he doesn't care about this. And like, people were using it to prove like both points. And it wasn't like that I cared or I didn't. Like, I didn't go climb that thing to be the first Black person to climb Moonlight Buttress. I mean, I actually did it because my friend James was like, hey, well, you're not going to climb El Cap. The weather's shitty. You should probably, I mean, the weather's bad. Sorry. Let's go climb Moonlight Buttress. And he kind of like pushed me to go try that. And I did. Like, so that was it, really. Like, it wasn't like I was out to set some kind of statement or that. I honestly didn't even think I'd send that thing. So.
Yeah, I guess. Like, I totally understand that. And I feel my understanding would be like, you know, again, back to the topic, it's like, you're a climber, you climbed Moonlight Buttress. Like, that's a huge accomplishment. You know, you weren't going into it being like, I'm going to be the first Black climber. I think it's interesting. Just, I think this, you know, Max, you can kind of help me out here a little bit, you know, with Kai Leitner and the first Black 515, like, in terms of representation, like, do you feel that these labels are important for representation and for the Black community? Like, do you feel like they are kind of going the opposite direction for what you feel is the best for the community?
That's just so hard, because like, my experience isn't the same as every other person of color. And I think like after I did send Moonlight Buttress, I think a lot of people were stoked about that. I think people from underrepresented communities were like, oh man, I see a person of color doing that. That is awesome. That's something I can do. The other one that I got, like, that kind of surprised me was a lot of people who work full time were like, oh yeah, Eddie's a teacher and he took a couple days off of work and went and got this thing done. Like, that's awesome. Like, I mean, I guess technically I am a pro climber now, but, usually it's like people who climb full time are the people who are, you know, doing these really big ascents. Not to say that there's definitely other like 9-to-5ers who are going up there and sending Moonlight Buttress. But I think that like that representation in any of those realms, I think, is important to help you think about what is possible. Because, you know, it's really hard to know your limit personally, right? Like, we all say like, there's these things we can't do. I could never do this. I could never do that. But once you start seeing people that are somewhat similar to you walking in your shoes, doing those similar things, I think that goes a long way. And I think that, I don't think you have to have first X, Y, or Z ascent, but I think being able to tell and share those stories that aren't just like, person goes and climbs 515D and you're like, what? I don't even know what that, what's the difference between 14A and 15D? You know what I mean?
Yeah, all Greek to me, man. Doesn't matter. Yeah.
So that's, yeah. I mean, I think it's important as a way, like in the storytelling aspect, but yeah, I don't know necessarily it's like those labels on routes necessarily need to be there.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's like, I think you're focusing on the story and what that means in terms of getting people inspired and getting people to take action and participate in the community. I think that definitely makes a lot of sense.
So can I won't say push back on that, but I guess something I'm wondering, which is a little bit of a contradiction then, is like, how does that perspective come in relation to the Full Circle expedition of like this first Black Everest expedition, if that makes sense? And like, sorry, not to like, I hope we're not like pushing back too hard. I'm just really interested in all this. And it seems like a very interesting conversation. So like, how does that perspective go in relation to the Full Circle expedition, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, Moonlight Buttress is like, that's my personal climbing. Like, that's mm-hmm. what I'm out to do. That's what I'm psyched to do. I didn't really care if there was media around it or not. Like, I wasn't a sponsored athlete at the time or anything like that. The Everest expedition, I mean, there was a lot that went on with the Everest expedition. One, I mean, Everest costs a ridiculous amount of money. Two, I think that there was, I mean, it was expensive, but also like the guy who the main idea was Phil Henderson. And I mean, he, you know, he's lived in my shoes for like being a part of the outdoor industry as a black person for like 30, 35 years, you know, I'm not even 35 years old, but, so he's kind of lived that. And I think, you know, one, we wanted to go to Everest, one, we had to market going to Everest. And so at that time, I think from a marketing standpoint, I mean, sorry, I don't know if you can hear my dog in the background. I mean,
that's all good.
It wasn't even an all black ascent. I mean, we worked with Sherpas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it wasn't an all black ascent. We had Sherpas on our team. We had Sherpas that I actually taught at the climbing school in Fort Say 6 months before the expedition. And then they worked with us there and helped. Like, we couldn't have summited the mountain without the Sherpas. But also, so I would say a lot of it in terms of that was like marketing. And also, like, this expedition, like, Phil proposed this more because he had the goal of inspiring people to climb, to get outside, to find, you know, something to inspire them. Because, I mean, when you look at the black and brown community, I think there is a, I mean, we have, you know, heart disease is a huge thing. I mean, there's a lot of sedentary folks. There's a lot of things, and a lot of, you know, black people ultimately, like, this project was, I would say, I think it inspired the community as a whole, but it was more to inspire like other people of color to like say like, hey, this is something that is okay. Cause there is a big thing within the black community. Like, oh man, climbing, that's white person stuff. Camping, that's white person stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's not necessarily true, but that exposure, right, to say like, hey, look, like there's a bunch of black people going in and climbing Everest. Like, you know, I managed the email and the Instagram for that for, you know, when we were getting off the ground. And so many people are like, oh man, you guys are trying to climb Everest. I guess I could go, like, you know, do a hike once a week or get outside once a week. Like, people are sending these emails, like, just really stoked to see this happen. So it's, that project, I think, was for a different purpose, and it was something that I got invited to do and then eventually agreed to and became involved with. And I think Phil wanted to make sure that he had a team that was fit to climb the mountain. And honestly, like, we look at lack of representation and lack of black people doing these things. And I mean, Phil had been doing this stuff for 35 years, and the team was made up of any person that he met that he thought could potentially be successful in Everest. And to see that's like a very, very small group of people.
Yeah.
Not to say that he's met every black person who climbs or has been in the outdoors ever, but from his experiences, right, that's very small.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great point, where hopefully I'm not putting words in your mouth, but it's almost like with like the nose and moonlight, it's like those were like, I hate the term selfish, but like selfish personal endeavors, just like for yourself. Whereas it seems like full circle is like, almost like the message of climbing was transcending to this community, and like the climb itself was secondary. Does that make sense? To like inspire individuals, right? So, and I think that makes sense. And like in relation to like, you know, Phil's experience with, I can't imagine, like, I'm 30 years old, but sometimes we take like progress for granted, and you can think of like, you know, the static place in time right now, like 2024, but like, you know, what was like Phil's experience getting into the outdoor community, like, you know, 30 years ago? It's like, it's totally crazy, right? And then like, we're still here where we are today. So yeah, it's easy to take the position you're in at that place in time for granted and just think like, oh yeah, progress or things getting better are just like self-evident, like osmosis is just like gonna happen, you know? And it's like, well, actually it's like been people doing things to like make that a reality, if that makes sense, over time.
Yeah.
A little tangential here, but like I have a funny note like in my notes, because like I think you summited Everest at like 2:30 in the morning, right? Is that true?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. I don't know why I found it really funny, just something like, not to diminish the ascent at all. Like, I can't imagine how cool it was, but I was like kind of like top of the world with no view. Like, like, I don't know why I found that funny, but I was like, did that bug you at all? Like being on the top and not having a view at all? Or was there just something like peaceful and serene about being in the darkness there, like on the top of the world?
I mean, honestly, it didn't really bug me. I don't know. I just, again, we just talked about this. Everest is more of like a community project, right?
Yeah.
And like, honestly, as soon as we raised enough money and like actually booked the flights and got to go to Nepal, it's like, man, okay, we made it. We're done. Like, yeah. That sounds really, really bad. And I'm not trying
the hard part's over.
Yeah. Wow, to be honest, like for real, like I was like up, you know, we were talking about being busy, like that year leading up to Everest was probably one of the hardest years of my life.
Wow.
I was every day, like I would go to work, I would teach, some afternoons I would coach. Then I would get on my computer and like, you know, check emails, do these things, email potential sponsors. Some days I'd have to like the media was showing up to my school, like asking if they could interview me about X, Y, or Z for the expedition. And yeah, I didn't sleep that year. And the worst part is I didn't really rock climb that much that year. And the rock climbing is the thing I was really stoked about. So
yeah,
like that was a really tough year in terms of like it wasn't just like people paid us to go climb Everest. It was like I literally worked another full-time job to raise money for this to happen. And it was kind of like me and Phil did the brunt of the fundraising. And so we were, you know, like I said, planning meetings every day, like working on the pitch deck, talking to companies, talking about deliverables. There's a film project that's at some point going to come out, and you just like, it's hard to not sleep and to not climb.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess to go back to the original question, like when we got there, I was like, oh man, this is nice. I can just like relax and like hike a little bit each day. And yeah, like I knew Everest was going to be hard, but like, that's like a challenge that like you're willingly putting yourself in a challenge to do those things. And I guess we were willingly to do all the other things, but I mean, sitting on checking emails is just not fun.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it.
Can I ask you one thing? What in the future is inspiring you? Like what's next? You know, you seem very like, you know, goal oriented and stuff. And so like what's inspiring you?
Yeah. Right now I'm still working on balance and everything. Like we're exactly where we started, right? Like how do you balance all of these things? And so I started doing a training plan because I want to get stronger. Like I don't want to say plateaued because I've diversified what I've been good at climbing for the past couple of years, but you know, I've been climbing in the same grade range for the past couple of years, and I want to try to go after some bigger objectives this summer, which involve being a little bit stronger. So I've been working on that this spring a lot, which has been a little bit less climbing outside, a little bit more hangboarding, which I absolutely hate doing. And so like right now we're just working on summer plans. Like I'll go to California for a lot of June and climb in Yosemite and just kind of get better at climbing on granite. And then the summer we're trying to figure out the most family baby friendly place to go climbing in the summer. And then nice. In the fall, I'm hoping to go out to the valley for probably like 10 days to climb. So
nice, man. Yeah.
That's yeah. Awesome. So I kind of just like, you know, structure the year around like, okay, how can I make the most out of my time off in the summer?
Yeah.
Now that you're a air quotes, or maybe even not air quotes, sponsored climber, do you feel like a pressure to perform more than you did before?
Not really. Honestly, like working with Patagonia, they've been great. They've been super, super relaxed. And they're like, as long as you just, you know, keep telling your story. And, you know, there's a lot of other random things that we do kind of as ambassadors, but, they've been really low pressure, which has been nice. But I guess for me personally, it's always like, you know, when I got into climbing, I always wanted to, you know, climb the diamond, climb another route on the diamond every summer. I was really intrigued in trying out big mountains, and I actually quit climbing big mountains before Everest came up, but I was really intrigued about like, you know, climbing big mountains. And so I was kind of always rotating between these like different genres and just different disciplines of climbing. And now I'm kind of back to the point where, oh, I want to try to climb something harder again. So Moonlight was nice. Like 2 years ago. And
the cycle continues.
You know what I mean? So it's just, that's, you guys are probably the same way with your climbing.
I don't know.
Maybe a little different. I want to climb harder grades, but I'm kind of in this perpetual cycle where it's like, I'm trying to do everything. You know, I'm trying to trail run. I'm trying to climb higher peaks. I'm trying to do high altitude. And then I'm trying to trad, you know, at Squamish in the summer. And it's like, eventually, if you want to really progress at one, you've got to kind of like pick that one and like stick with it. And that's been hard because it's just too fun. Yeah. There's too many good sports to do, you know. It's like, yeah, I want to do it all. So, but that's tricky. Yeah.
I think it all like kind of helps in a way, right? Like, mm-hmm. like if you're trail running, then you can be out for really long days. If you're, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. I feel like it all helps piece together a little bit. And I don't know. I think at least for me, like if I just bouldered, like right now I'm just hangboarding. I know I'm going to get burnt out from hangboarding at some point.
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for your time. And yeah, I feel like we had a great conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Likewise. Awesome. Really appreciate your time, Eddie, and everything. I know you're, you know, super busy guy. And so we do really appreciate you coming on the show and having a chat with us. So thanks again.
Yeah, no problem. Hopefully you got some good content that people enjoy.